a densely wooded ridge about a mile and a half to the south, known as the Heights of Gowan, which ran like a natural defense between the forts and the broad flatlands to the south. Earthworks and gun emplacements were also underway on Little Governor's Island between the Heights and Red Hook in the direct path of the entrance to the East River. "We have done a great deal," Washington could claim in early May. "Governor's Island has a large and strong work erected. The point below, called Red Hook, has a small but exceedingly strong mounted battery. And several new works are constructed, and many of them almost executed at other places." Barricades were thrown up within the city itself. In the words of a surviving British intelligence report, "Every street facing both North and East Rivers has wooden trunks made across, 10 feet thick, filled with earth, in order to intercept any troops that may attempt a landing." There were guns along the banks of the Hudson, heavy cannon at Old Fort George by the battery, and more at the Whitehall dock on the East River. Henry Knox was proud to report that 120 cannon were in place in and about the city, and this time ample ammunition was standing by. The one glaring problem was an acute shortage of artillerymen. Knowing how many soldiers in the ranks were without muskets or arms of any kind, Knox persuaded Washington to reassign 500 or 600 of them to the artillery. Never mind that they were entirely inexperienced, almost any live body being preferable to nothing. The daily labors of the artillerymen were hardly less wearisome than those of the troops digging trenches and throwing up earthworks, and potentially a great deal more dangerous, as the diary of the Massachusetts soldier Solomon Nash gives some suggestion. "Monday, May 13th, fetched 132-pounder from the fort and placed it to the eastward of the Grand Battery, employed in piling up shot. Thursday, May 16th, some of us employed in firing our cannon with double charges in them, to prove them, and they all proved good, but two. One of them split at the muzzle, and the other at the Grand Battery burst all in pieces. One piece went 30 or 40 rods, about 200 yards, and fell upon a house, through the roof and all the floors to the last one, which hurt the house very much, but hurt nobody. Wednesday, May 22nd, employed in making cartridges. Friday, May 31st, bigger part of our regiment employed in making cartridges. So ends this month." In early June, Knox and Green rode together to the rugged uppermost end of York Island to survey a craggy ridge 230 feet above the Hudson, the highest point on the island, as the site for still another major defense, and work soon commenced on what was to be called Fort Washington, intended to keep the British Navy from coming up the river. Another fort, to be known as Fort Constitution, was also planned for the opposite side of the Hudson. The friendship of Knox and Green that had begun in Knox's Boston bookshop continued to grow, as the two officers found themselves increasingly important in the overall command, and nearly always in agreement on matters of consequence. In their admiration of and loyalty to Washington, they were of one heart, and both had begun helping Washington in his dealings with Congress. Green, in a letter stressing the urgent need for more troops, told John Adams, head of the Board of War, that if Congress were to provide support for those soldiers maimed or killed, that this in itself would increase enlistments and inspire those engaged with as much courage as any measure that can be fixed upon. He wrote, too, of the low morale among officers whose pay was not enough to defray even ordinary expenses. "Good officers were the very soul of an army," Green wrote. "The Congress must not be overconfident. The fate of war is very uncertain," he warned. "Suppose this army should be defeated, two or three of the leading generals killed, our stores and magazines all lost. I would not be answerable for the consequences that such a stroke might produce in American politics." At Adams' request, Knox provided a list of recommended books on military matters, and in a letter to Adams of May 16th, Knox expressed in the strongest terms his belief that it was time to declare American independence. Like Washington, like Green, and like Adams, Knox longed ardently for a separation from Britain, and the sooner the better. the future happiness or misery of a great proportion of the human race is at stake, and if we make a wrong choice, ourselves and our posterity must be wretched. Wrong choice? There can be but one choice consistent with the character of a people possessing the least degree of reason. And that is to separate from that people who, from a total dissolution of virtue among them, must be our enemies, an event which I devoutly pray may soon take place, and let it be as soon as may be. As Martha Washington had joined the Commander-in-Chief in New York, so Lucy Knox and Katie Green traveled from New England to be with their husbands, each young woman bringing an infant born within the year, little Lucy Knox and George Washington Green. An undated invitation sent from Green's Long Island quarters that spring reads, "General Green and Lady present their compliments to Colonel Knox and his lady, and should be glad of their company tomorrow at dinner at 2 o'clock." Through days of toil on defenses, through endless hours taken up with military routine, endless problems of supply and paperwork, and the innumerable day-to-day preoccupations of those trying to carry on with the little that remained of normal civilian life, the thought that the British could appear any time was seldom out of mind. Every soldier, every civilian, it seemed, had one eye cocked on the harbor for the first sign of British sails. Every waking day began with the thought that it could be the day. Washington ordered a signal system set up between Long Island, Staten Island, and New York. On May 18th, a rumor flew through the city that the British had been sighted off Sandy Hook in the lower bay, and though there was nothing to it, the story carried for days. The number of sentries at gun emplacements was doubled. They were not to suffer any person whatever to go into the batteries at night, Washington's order read. Nor is any person whatever but generals or field officers of the army and officers and men of the artillery who have real business there to be permitted even in daytime. More orders followed. Soldiers were to lay upon, sleep with, their arms and be ready to turn out at a minute's notice. To practice the use of their arms, they were each to fire at least 2 rounds, and practice moving rapidly from their camps into the trenches and fortifications, to become familiar with the ground they would have to cover when the attack came. According to his own returns, Washington had 8,880 men at hand, 6,923 of whom were fit for duty. At the same time, he had received reliable word that no fewer than 17,000 hired German troops were on the way to serve under the British command, and that the full enemy force could number as many as 30,000. When Washington was called to Philadelphia to consult with Congress, arrangements were made for fast horses to be held ready at intervals along the road, so that if necessary, he could get back to New York with the utmost expedition. It was the first time Washington had left the army since taking command. No sooner had he departed, on May 21st, leaving General Putnam in charge, than the rumor spread that he had gone to Philadelphia to resign his command. When he returned on June 6th, after an absence of 2 weeks, it was to a rousing welcome, with drums rolling and 5 regiments parading. "Through Broadway we marched, round the king's statue," wrote Lieutenant Bangs, jubilant, like all the army, at the commander's presence among them once more. There was further bleak news from Canada, including word that General John Thomas, who had been sent north with the expectation that he could set things straight there, had died of smallpox. The one positive development for Washington was that during his stay in Philadelphia, he had convinced Joseph Reed to rejoin the army, to serve as the army's adjutant general, its administrative head, with the rank of colonel, in place of General Horatio Gates, who had been sent by Congress to see what he could do about Canada. Reed returned full of misgivings. He questioned his fitness for the job. "It is so entirely out of my line," he told his wife, and in a few days he was ready to quit again. But Washington's faith in the gifted Reed and his need for a confidant were no less than ever. To Washington, his return was a godsend. Suddenly, with the impact of an explosion, news of a Loyalist plot to assassinate the commander-in-chief burst upon the city. A dozen men were arrested, including the mayor of New York, David Matthews, and two soldiers from Washington's own Life Guard. The plot, reportedly, was to kill Washington and his officers the moment the British fleet appeared. Patriot mobs took to the streets to hunt down Loyalists. Those they seized were beaten, tarred, and feathered, burned with candles, or made to ride the rail, the cruel punishment whereby a man was forced to straddle a sharp fence rail held on the shoulders of two men, with other men on either side taking a grip on his legs to keep him straight, and thus the victim was paraded through the streets. "Dear brother," a New Yorker named Peter Elting wrote approvingly on June 13th, "we had some grand Tory rides in this city this week, and in particular yesterday. Several of them were handled very roughly, being carried through the streets on rails. Their clothes tore from their back, and their bodies pretty well mingled with the dust." A local Moravian pastor, Ewald Schukirk, writing in his diary of such very unhappy and shocking scenes, noted also, some of the generals, and especially Putnam and their forces, had enough to do to quell the riot and make the mob disperse. Washington shifted his headquarters to City Hall. Knox and his wife moved into No. 1 Broadway, while Martha Washington remained at the Mortier House beyond the city. All this apparently out of concern for Washington's safety. What was learned of the plot in the course of a court-martial of the two soldiers from the Life Guard was less sensational than first reported, but serious indeed, even if the evidence was thin. According to the accused themselves, the plan had been to recruit other soldiers to sabotage gun emplacements when the fleet arrived, in return for royal pardons and financial bonuses, encouragement as to land and houses. Besides the mayor, the others arrested and imprisoned included two doctors, a shoemaker, a tailor, a chandler, and a former schoolteacher. But only one of the soldiers was convicted, an English immigrant named Thomas Hickey, whose defense was that he'd gotten involved only for the sake of cheating Tories and getting some money from them. Hickey was hanged before an enormous crowd on June 28th, a fate that most of the army approved. "I wish 20 more were served the same," wrote Joseph Hodgkins. That same night, Washington learned for the first time that the British had sailed from Halifax, bound for New York, on June 9th. General Howe having departed somewhat earlier on the frigate Greyhound. The information came by express rider from the captain of an American schooner that had been captured by the Greyhound off Cape Ann, then retaken by an armed American sloop. The next morning, Saturday, June 29th, officers with telescopes on the roof of Washington's headquarters and other vantage points in the city and on Long Island saw signals flying from the hills of Staten Island. The first of the British fleet had appeared. In a matter of hours, 45 ships had dropped anchor inside Sandy Hook in the lower bay, 10 miles beyond the Narrows. To a Pennsylvania rifleman closer at hand, their masts looked like a forest of trimmed pine trees. I declare, I thought all London was afloat. Henry and Lucy Knox were at breakfast at No. 1 Broadway when they saw the fleet. It had become their practice to enjoy breakfast beside a large Palladian window on the second floor, with a panoramic view of the harbor. But now suddenly the morning was shattered, and Lucy Knox was in a state of abject terror. "You can scarcely conceive of the distress and anxiety which she then had," Knox would write to his brother William. "The city in an uproar, the alarm guns firing, the troops repairing to their posts, and everything in the height of bustle. I not at liberty to attend her, as my country cries loudest." For weeks, Knox had been urging Lucy to leave the city for her own safety and that of their infant daughter. "My God, may I never experience the like feelings again. They were too much, but I found a way to disguise them, for I scolded like a fury at her for not having gone before." By sunset, the enemy ships at anchor down the bay numbered more than 100. Riders galloped off to Connecticut and New Jersey to spread the news and hurry on the militia. Martha Washington said her goodbyes to her husband and departed the city by carriage with all possible speed, as did Lucy Knox, Katie Green, and their children, along with hundreds more of the city's inhabitants. The great being who watches the hearts of the children of men knows I value you above every blessing, and for that reason I wish you to be at such a distance from the horrid scenes of war, Knox wrote to Lucy after she reached Connecticut. And lest anyone forget all that was at stake, he reminded her, "We are fighting for our country, for posterity, perhaps. On the success of this campaign, the happiness or misery of millions may depend." Further details on the makeup of the enemy armada followed quickly. The ships included the Centurion and the Chatham, of 50 guns each, the 40-gun Phoenix, and the 30-gun Greyhound with General Howe on board, in addition to the 64-gun Asia. In their combined firepower, these five warships alone far exceeded all the American guns now in place on shore. Nathaniel Green reported to Washington that the total fleet of 120 ships had 10,000 troops received at Halifax, besides some of the Scotch Brigade that have joined the fleet on the passage. And as Lieutenant Colonel Samuel Webb of Washington's staff further noted, an additional 15,000 to 20,000 could be expected hourly on still more ships from England under the command of General Howe's brother, Admiral Richard Lord Howe. "The whole of New York was in commotion," wrote Pastor Schuchkerk. "On the one hand, everyone that could was packing up and getting away, and on the other hand, country soldiers from the neighboring places came in from all sides." On Long Island, one of Nathaniel Green's field officers took time to pen a note to his son back home in Newburyport, Massachusetts. "I am of opinion our hands will be full," wrote Colonel Moses Little, a veteran of Bunker Hill. In Philadelphia, the same day as the British landing on Staten Island, July 2, 1776, the Continental Congress, in a momentous decision, voted to dissolve the connection with Great Britain. The news reached New York 4 days later, on July 6, and at once spontaneous celebrations broke out. "The whole choir of our officers went to a public house to testify our joy at the happy news of independence. We spent the afternoon merrily," recorded Isaac Bangs. A letter from John Hancock to Washington, as well as the complete text of the declaration, followed 2 days later. "That our affairs may take a more favorable turn," Hancock wrote, "the Congress have judged it necessary to dissolve the connection between Great Britain and the American colonies, and to declare them free and independent states. As you will perceive by the enclosed declaration, which I am directed to transmit to you, and to request you will have it proclaimed at the head of the army in the way you shall think most proper." Many, like Henry Knox, saw at once that with the enemy massing for battle so close at hand, and independence at last declared by Congress, the war had entered an entirely new stage. The lines were drawn now as never before, the stakes far higher. "The eyes of all America are upon us," Knox wrote. "As we play our part, posterity will bless or curse us." By renouncing their allegiance to the king, the delegates at Philadelphia had committed treason and embarked on a course from which there could be no turning back. "We are in the very midst of a revolution," wrote John Adams, "the most complete, unexpected, and remarkable of any in the history of nations." In a ringing preamble drafted by Thomas Jefferson, the document declared it self-evident that all men are created equal and were endowed with the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to this noble end the delegates had pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Such courage and high ideals were of little consequence, of course, the declaration itself being no more than a declaration, without military success against the most formidable force on earth. John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, an eminent member of Congress who opposed the declaration, had called it a skiff made of paper, and as Nathaniel Green had warned, there were never any certainties about the fate of war. But from this point on, the citizen soldiers of Washington's army were no longer to be fighting only for the defense of their country, or for their rightful liberties as freeborn Englishmen, as they had at Lexington and Concord, Bunker Hill, and through the long siege at Boston. It was now a proudly proclaimed all-out war for an independent America, a new America, and thus a new day of freedom and equality. At his home in Newport, Nathaniel Green's mentor, the Reverend Ezra Stiles, wrote in his diary almost in disbelief, "Thus the Congress has tied a Gordian knot, which the Parliament will find they can neither cut nor untie. The 13 United Colonies now rise into an independent republic among the kingdoms, states, and empires on earth. And have I lived to see such an important and astonishing revolution?" At a stroke, the Continental Congress had made the glorious cause of America more glorious still, for all the world to know, and also to give every citizen soldier, at this critical juncture, something still larger and more compelling for which to fight. Washington saw it as a fresh incentive, and to his mind it had come not a moment too soon. On Tuesday, July 9th, at 6 in the evening, on his orders, the several brigades in the city were marched onto the commons and other parade grounds to hear the declaration read aloud. "The general hopes that this important event will serve as a fresh incentive to every officer and soldier to act with fidelity and courage," the orders read, "as knowing that now the peace and safety of his country depends, under God, solely on the success of our arms, and that he is now in the service of a state possessed of sufficient power to reward his merit and advance him to the highest honors of a free country." The formal readings concluded, a great mob of cheering, shouting soldiers and townspeople stormed down Broadway to Bowling Green, where with ropes and bars they pulled down the gilded lead statue of George III on his colossal horse. In their fury, the crowd hacked off the sovereign's head, severed the nose, clipped the laurels that wreathed the head, and mounted what remained of the head on a spike outside a tavern. Much of the lead from the rest of the statue would later be, as reported, melted down for bullets to assimilate with the brains of our infatuated adversaries. Not since the spring of 1775 had spirits been so high, but the exuberance of the moment, or any thoughts that grand pronouncements and the toppling of symbolic monuments were sufficient to change the course of history, were quickly dashed in dramatic fashion 3 days later, on July 12th. In a surprise move, the British demonstrated for all to see how much the defenders of New York had still to learn, and the larger, ominous truth that without sea power, New York was indefensible. It was a brilliant summer day with a brisk wind out of the southwest, ideal sailing conditions. At approximately 3 in the afternoon, His Majesty's ships Phoenix and Rose, in the company of 3 tenders, cast off their moorings at Staten Island and started up the harbor under full sail, moving swiftly with the favorable wind and a perfect flood tide. Alarm guns sounded in New York. Soldiers rushed in every direction through streets crowded with panic-stricken people. The cannon at Red Hook and Governor's Island opened fire, and as the ship swept by Lower Manhattan, heading into the mouth of the Hudson, the guns at Old Fort George and other shore batteries opened up. Commanding the fire from Fort George was a 19-year-old captain of New York artillery, Alexander Hamilton, who had left King's College to serve in the cause. The ships returned the fire. Cannonballs slammed into houses and came bounding down streets still swarming with people. Washington would write of the extreme distress he felt at the shrieks and cries of women and children running every which way, and at the spectacle of his own men standing at the water's edge gawking helplessly, so awestruck or terrified were they by the ferocious barrage let loose by the enemy ships. Private Joseph Martin, the 15-year-old Connecticut recruit, would remember enjoying a complete view of the whole affair, It was his first experience with the muttering of cannon fire, and he rather thought the sound was musical, or at least grand. Every battery along the Hudson fired away until cannon smoke lay thick and heavy over the city, and the air reeked of gunpowder. The British ships, keeping close to the New Jersey shore, proceeded rapidly up the river and were soon out of sight. By 5:30 they had passed the blasts of cannon from Fort Washington, and by evening they were safely anchored 30 miles above the city, in the broadest part of the Hudson, the Tappan Zee at Tarrytown, where their mission was to cut off rebel supplies and rouse local loyalists. American gun crews had fired nearly 200 shots, more than 150 from the New York batteries alone, and to no apparent effect. According to the log of the Rose, the Americans shot away our starboard foreshroud, foretackle pendant, forelift, fore topsail clew lines, spritsail, and main topsail braces, one 18-pound shot in the head of our foremast and one through the pinnace, several through the sails, and some in the hull. Knox's guns had proven more deadly to his own men than to the foe. 6 American artillerymen were killed, the only fatalities of the day, when their cannon blew up due to their own inexperience or overconfidence, or possibly, as said, because a great many were drunk. In his ensuing general orders, Washington could barely conceal his disgust over the inexcusable behavior displayed in the face of the enemy, and the shame he felt over officers who, instead of attending to their duty, had stood gazing like bumpkins. To the proud Washington, he and the army had been made a laughingstock. Such unsoldierly conduct must grieve every good officer and give the enemy a mean opinion of the army, as nothing shows the brave and good soldier more than in case of alarms coolly and calmly repairing to his post and there waiting his orders, whereas a weak curiosity at such a time makes a man look mean and contemptible. Knox wrote privately that while the loss of his men had been a great misfortune, he consoled himself with the hope that the day's actions had taught the rest to be less impetuous the next time. But there was a far larger, more ominous lesson in what had happened. Clearly, if 2 enemy warships, with their tenders, could pass so swiftly and readily up the Hudson, suffering no serious damage from the onshore batteries, then so could 10 or 20 warships and transports, or for that matter, an entire British fleet. And by landing an army of 10,000 or more upriver, they could cut off any chance Washington and his forces might have for escape from New York. To compound Washington's torment, the day's drama closed in late afternoon with the spectacle of the 64-gun HMS Eagle, steadily advancing up the bay with all canvas spread, and the flag of St. George flying at the foretop masthead, signifying it was the flagship of Admiral Lord Howe, and that therefore the fleet from England and still more troops could not be far behind. In the gathering dusk of New York, the boom of a Royal Navy salute came rolling across the waters. Morale in the British ranks had never been higher. After the miseries of the winter in Boston and months of bleak isolation at Halifax, then more wearisome weeks at sea, Staten Island in summer seemed a paradise. "We are in very comfortable cantonments amongst a loyal and liberal people, who supply us in plenty and in agreeable variety all the necessaries of life, most of which we have been long deprived of," wrote a British officer. "We are in the most beautiful island that nature could form or art improve," declared another. "Here," reported a third, "we experience greater luxury than we have done since the commencement of hostilities. Fresh meat, eggs, butter, milk, and vegetables, and all on reasonable terms." Captain Archibald Robertson hiked to the nearby hills with his painting kit to do watercolor sketches as he had at Boston. The difference here was the greater scale of everything spread before him. The sweep of the surpassing harbor defined by New York and Long Island in the distance, and the far larger British fleet now riding at anchor in the middle foreground. the red-coated soldiers found themselves well-nourished and welcome on American soil in a way they had never been, indeed openly greeted with greatest joy. "We have now a very good supply of salt provisions," summarized still another officer, "a great quantity of rum, an immense quantity of ammunition of all kinds, and what is best of all, the very people who we suspected would oppose us are coming over to us in great numbers." Hardly a day passed without distraught Loyalists or American deserters turning up filled with tales of woe, many of them having crossed at night by boat from Long Island or New York. Ambrose Searle, a patriotic young Englishman and fluent writer who served as a civilian secretary to Admiral Howe, recorded in his journal how his heart went out to the Loyalists. "It excited one's sympathy to see their poor, meager faces," he wrote of several who had escaped from Long Island, "and to hear their complaints of being hunted for their lives like game into the woods and swamps, only because they would not renounce their allegiance to their king and affection for their country." For deserters, there was considerably less sympathy and little or no trust. "There was no believing these poor, deluded wretches," wrote Colonel Charles Stewart, summing up what most British officers felt. "General James Grant thought no American could be trusted, Loyalist any more than the rest." "The inhabitants of this island," Grant concluded from his observations, "hate the rebel army because they have been oppressed by them. But from the confession and conversation of our most loyal subjects of Staten Island, I am quite confirmed in my opinion that we have not a friend in America." This, however, was not the view of the more astute General Howe, who saw immediately in the Loyalists an advantage he had been denied at Boston. "I met with Governor Tryon on board a ship at the Hook, and many gentlemen, fast friends to the government attending him, from whom I have had the fullest information on the state of the rebels," Howe had reported to Lord Germain on July 7th, just days after landing at Staten Island. "News of the Declaration of Independence only served to underscore the villainy and madness of these deluded people," an outraged Ambrose Searle observed. "A more impudent, false, and atrocious proclamation was never fabricated by the hands of man." Soldiers in His Majesty's ranks talked of the sporting season about to begin. The lust for the hunt was stronger than ever, their officers happily took note. All rebels were fair game. "The troops hold them very cheap," wrote Searle, "and long for an opportunity of revenging the cause of their countrymen who fell at Bunker Hill." Lord Rawdon, a veteran of Bunker Hill and of the siege of Boston, who had taken delight in the hatred his men felt for Yankees, was cheered now by the number of soldiers being court-martialed for rape, this being perfect proof, he wrote, of their improved diet, and of what a spirited lot they were. "The fair nymphs of this isle are in wonderful tribulation, as the fresh meat our men have got here has made them as riotous as satyrs. A girl cannot step into the bushes to pluck a rose without running the most imminent risk of being ravished, and they are so little accustomed to these vigorous methods that they don't bear them with the proper resignation, and of consequence we have most entertaining courts-martial every day." Yet the courts-martial were themselves proof that such conduct was no laughing matter to the British command, and in fact those convicted faced punishment far more severe than what was customarily dispensed in the American army. Writing earlier to the Earl of Huntingdon, the handsome Lord Rawdon had expressed the hope that "we shall soon have done with these American scoundrels, for one only dirties one's fingers by meddling with them. I do not imagine they can possibly last out beyond this campaign, if you give us the necessary means of carrying on the war with vigor." Now, with the necessary means gathering in such heartening numbers on Staten Island, he eagerly anticipated the moment when the Yankee psalm singers, as he loved to call them, crossed paths with the likes of the newly arrived Scottish Highlanders, armed with their murderous broadswords. Through telescopes, a dozen or more distant rebel camps could be distinctly seen, and the enemy appeared very numerous. From what could be learned from Loyalists and deserters, rebel strength in New York and on Long Island was overestimated to be between 30 and 35,000. But few, if any, of the British doubted that the conflict ahead would prove fatal to the rebel army, or that it would be exceedingly bloody. Among many officers, the chief worry was that the Americans might not fight. As one wrote anonymously in a letter published in London's Morning Chronicle, "Our only fear is that the rebels will not choose to hazard a general action. If they are determined to act upon the defensive only, our work will never be done." Even before the successful dash of the Phoenix and the Rose up the Hudson, it had been assumed by many British officers that the assault on New York would be made to the north, and thus the army would advance on the city from the undefended rear, while the Royal Navy let loose with a heavy bombardment from the rivers and harbor. But General Howe was saying little of his plans, except that the wait would continue until full reinforcements had arrived. The general, too, was enjoying the comparative comforts of Staten Island, as well as the company of the comely Mrs. Loring, and characteristically, he appeared to be in no hurry. To what extent his brother the admiral would influence or even determine strategy henceforth was an open question and important, since both the admiral and the general had been lately assigned by the king to serve in the oddly ambiguous, potentially conflicting role of peace commissioners. The general was known to want decisive action as the surest way to wind things up quickly, which was also the adamant view of George Lord Germain, from whom he took his orders. And unlike some of his officers, he was certain the Americans would fight. In a letter written before sailing for New York from Halifax, he had said they were undoubtedly spoiling for a fight, that flushed with the idea of superiority after the evacuation of Boston, they may be readier brought to a decisive action, and that nothing was more to be desired or sought for as the most effective means to terminate this expensive war. Whether the admiral carried an olive branch or a sword was unclear, but his presence on the Eagle and the prospect of more men of war and transports arriving had a huge effect. The admiral was a renowned fighting sailor, and as the older, less self-indulgent of the brothers, and with an even darker, gloomier cast to his expression, Black Dick, as he was known affectionately, was thought to be the wiser of the two. The fact that they were of like mind on most matters military and political, and got along well, seemed to preclude the friction and jealousies between the Royal Navy and the Army, frequently endemic to such joint operations. Whatever strategy was resolved, the assumption was that the sea and land forces would work in close cooperation and harmony. On Saturday, July 13th, General Howe and his staff, joined by Royal Governor Tryon, dined with the admiral in his cabin on board the Eagle. The discussion turned upon military affairs, upon the country and upon the rebels, and lasted well into the evening. The next day came another surprise move, when Lord Howe sent a picked officer from the Eagle, Lieutenant Philip Brown, across the bay to New York under a flag of truce, carrying a letter addressed to George Washington, Esquire. Brown was met by Joseph Reed, who, on Washington's orders, had hurried to the waterfront, accompanied by Henry Knox and Samuel Webb. "I have a letter, sir, from Lord Howe to Mr. Washington," Lieutenant Brown began. "Sir," replied Reed, "we have no person in our army with that address." When Brown asked by what title Mr. Washington chose to be addressed, Reed replied, "You are sensible, sir, of the rank of General Washington in our army." "Yes, sir, we are," answered Brown. "I am sure Lord Howe will lament exceedingly this affair, as the letter is quite of a civil nature and not a military one." "Lord Howe also lamented exceedingly that he was not here sooner," Brown added, implying that the admiral regretted not arriving in New York before the Declaration of Independence. Brown returned to the Eagle to report the response of the Americans. "So high is the vanity and insolence of these men," huffed Ambrose Searle in his journal. But the admiral persisted. 3 days later, Brown departed again under a white flag, the letter now addressed to George Washington, Esquire, etc., etc. But again, it was declined. The day after, the admiral made a third try, this time sending a different messenger, a captain named Nisbet Balfour, to inquire whether General Washington would receive the adjutant general to General Howe, Colonel James Patterson. This time the answer was yes. Thus, exactly at noon, Saturday, July 20th, Colonel Patterson arrived at New York and was escorted directly to No. 1 Broadway, where he met Washington with all due formality, with Reed, Knox, and others in attendance. Washington's guard stood at attention at the entrance. Washington, as Knox wrote, was very handsomely dressed and made a most elegant appearance, while Patterson conducted himself with what Reed considered the greatest politeness and attention. Seated across a table from Washington, Patterson assured him that Lord Howe did not mean to derogate from the respect or rank of General Washington. Both Lord and General Howe held the person and character of General Washington in highest esteem, Patterson said. But when he took from his pocket the same letter, addressed still to George Washington, Esquire, etc., etc., and placed it on the table between them, Washington let it lie, pointedly refusing to touch it. The use of etc., etc. implied everything that ought to follow, Patterson offered by way of explanation. It so does, said Washington, and anything. A letter addressed to a person in a position of public responsibility ought to indicate that station, Washington said. Otherwise, it would appear mere private correspondence. He would not accept such a letter. Patterson talked of the goodness and benevolence of the king, who had appointed Lord and General Howe as commissioners to accommodate this unhappy dispute. As Reed would write in a report to Congress, a report soon published in the Pennsylvania Journal, Washington replied simply that he was not vested with any powers on this subject by those from whom he derived his authority and power. It was his understanding, Washington continued, that Lord Howe had come out from London with authority only to grant pardons. If that was so, he had come to the wrong place. Those who have committed no fault want no pardon, Washington said plainly. We are only defending what we deem our indisputable rights. According to Henry Knox, the English officer appeared as awestruck as if before something supernatural. Patterson said he lamented an adherence to forms might obstruct business of the greatest moment and concern. The meeting over, as Patterson himself would write, the general, with a great deal of marked attention and civility, permitted me to take my leave. It had been a scene that those in the room would long remember. Washington had performed his role to perfection. It was not enough that a leader look the part by Washington's rules. He must know how to act it with self-command and precision. John Adams would later describe Washington approvingly as one of the great actors of the age. To Washington, it had been an obligatory farce. He had no faith, no trust whatever, in any peace overtures by the British, however properly rendered. He had agreed to take part in such an interview, one senses, partly to show the British and his own staff that he could go through the motions quite as well as any officer and gentleman, but more importantly to send a message to the British command absent any ambiguity, and in this he was unmistakably successful. As Lord Howe would report to Lord Germain on the prospect of an accommodation acceptable to the king, the interview induced me to change my subscription for the attainment of an end so desirable. British ships kept arriving, their sails at first tiny glints on the eastern horizon, then growing steadily larger by the hour as they came up through the Narrows. Samuel Webb counted 5 ships on July 25th, 8 on July 26th. On July 29th, another 20 arrived. A midsummer drought had set in. The heat was fierce. Just as the winter of 1776 had been one of extreme cold, so the summer was one of extreme heat. No air and the thermometer at 94 degrees, recorded Ambrose Searle on board the Eagle. Henry Knox, writing to Lucy at his desk at No. 1 Broadway, said he had never worked so hard or felt so done in by the heat. I generally rise with or a little before the sun and immediately, with part of the regiment, attend prayers, sing a psalm, or read a chapter of the Bible. I dispatch a considerable deal of business before breakfast. From breakfast to dinner, I am boiling in a sun hot enough to roast an egg. Indeed, my dear Lucy, I never suffered so much from fatigue in my life. On August 1st, a swarm of 45 ships carrying Generals Henry Clinton and Charles Cornwallis and some 3,000 troops were sighted off Sandy Hook, newly returned from South Carolina and making a very fine appearance in the eyes of the exultant British. To the Americans, the ships and Clinton's army were as unexpected as if they had dropped from the clouds. And still, ships kept coming. On August 4th, Nathaniel Greene reported that another 21 had been counted on the horizon, the whole of Lord Howe's fleet. And as if to underscore the ambiguity of the admiral's mission, transports loaded with troops bore such names as Good Intent, Friendship, Amity's Admonition, and Father's Goodwill. "We have had so many arrivals of late," wrote a nearly giddy Ambrose Searle, "that the rebel commanders, we learn, give out to their people that we send ships down in the night, which come up in the course of the next day, as a maneuver to intimidate them." Joseph Reed, writing to a friend, said that no fewer than 100 ships had arrived within 10 days, and as yet only part of the foreign Hessian troops had come in. Reed, it appears, was indeed intimidated. For the first time, he expressed great misgivings over the wisdom of even trying to defend New York against such a force. "It is a mere point of honor that keeps us here now." He had a different strategy in mind. "My opinion is," he wrote, "we should make it a war of posts, prolong, procrastinate, avoid any general action, or indeed any action, unless we have great advantages." As things were, he saw no advantages. To what degree he was pressing such views on his commander by this time is not known. Even stalwart, optimistic Henry Knox suffered his own private anguish. "I shrink and tremble at the importance of our present conduct. The weight absolute without alleviation of perhaps posterity on the shoulders of the present army. An army, I am sorry to say, that is not sufficiently numerous to resist the formidable attacks which will probably be made," he told his brother in a letter of August 5th. Washington remained determined to make a stand, convinced still that the city must be defended. On August 12th, the sea beyond the Narrows was filled with yet another 100 ships or more bearing down on New York, a fleet so large that it took all day for them to come up the harbor under full canvas, colors flying, guns saluting, sailors and soldiers on the ships and on shore cheering themselves hoarse. In addition, another 3,000 British troops and more than 8,000 Hessians had arrived after an arduous 3 months at sea. Nothing like it had ever been seen in New York. Housetops were covered with gazers. All wharves that offered a view were jammed with people. The total British armada, now at anchor in a long, thick cluster off Staten Island, numbered nearly 400 ships, large and small. 73 warships, including 8 ships of the line, each mounting 50 guns or more. As British officers happily reminded one another, it was the largest fleet ever seen in American waters. In fact, it was the largest expeditionary force of the 18th century, the largest, most powerful force ever sent forth from Britain or any nation. But it was also true that as big as the biggest ships were, and to Americans who had never seen anything like them, they were colossal, they could have been bigger still. Even the Asia and Eagle were small compared to other ships in the British fleet. HMS Victory, for example, mounted fully 98 guns. Concerned about the difficulties of clearing the shallows of Sandy Hook and negotiating the East River and the Hudson, Admiral Lord Howe had wisely chosen speed and maneuverability over size and more massive firepower. Still, by the scale of things in the American colonies of 1776, it was a display of military might past imagining. All told, 32,000 troops had landed on Staten Island, a well-armed, well-equipped, trained force more numerous than the entire population of New York or even Philadelphia, which, with a population of about 30,000, was the largest city in America. Joseph Reed, writing to his wife, expressed what many felt. "When I look down and see the prodigious fleet they have collected, the preparations they have made, and consider the vast expenses incurred, I cannot help being astonished that a people should come 3,000 miles at such risk, trouble, and expense to rob, plunder, and destroy another people because they will not lay their lives and fortunes at their feet." In the tent encampments dotting Staten Island, the Redcoats were in holiday spirits. But so it was also on the American side, among such veterans of the Boston campaign as Jabez Fitch in camp in New York, and Joseph Hodgkins on Long Island, who had no doubt the troops would give a good account of themselves, whatever was to come. Their confidence was bolstered in large degree by distorted notions of their own strength. "It was true enough that the enemy was coming in almost every day," wrote Hodgkins to his wife, "and they might number as many as 25,000. Yet she need not worry, for we have 42,000 men now, and they are coming in every day." One newspaper said the American army numbered 70,000. Many of the new arrivals looked the way soldiers were supposed to, in smart uniforms and well-armed, and they marched into town full of pride. Delaware, the smallest colony, had sent the largest battalion in the army, the Delaware Blues, a force of 800 turned out in handsome red-trimmed blue coats, white waistcoats, buckskin breeches, white woolen stockings, and carrying fine, lately imported English muskets. The proud Maryland Battalion, commanded by General William Smallwood, was composed of men of honor, family, and fortune, and if anything, they were even better armed and more dazzling, in scarlet coats lined with buff. Colonel John Glover's tough Massachusetts fishermen wore the blue jackets of sailors, white shirts, white breeches, and caps, while their short, stocky, red-haired commander had silver lace trim on his blue broadcloth coat and carried a brace of silver pistols. But while the incoming stream of reinforcements had become a daily spectacle, desertions were increasing by the day, and signing up new recruits was proving ever more difficult, in part because that summer of 1776 was a bumper year on American farms, and men could rightly claim to be needed at home. "Their complaints are without number," the colonel of a Connecticut regiment wrote. "Some have got 10 or 12 loads of hay cut, and not a man left to take it up. Some have got a great quantity of grass to cut. Some have not finished hoeing corn. Some, if not all, have got their plowing to do for sowing their winter grain. Some have all their families sick, and not a person left to take care of them." In the oppressive summer heat in New York and on Long Island, camp fever had become epidemic. When Lieutenant Hodgkins allowed to his wife, Sarah, that a good many of our people are poorly, that was hardly the half of it. Hodgkins was worried sick over his youngest child, a 2-year-old son and namesake, who he had learned was deathly ill at home, and he was no doubt trying to spare her still more worry. In the regiment in which Jabez Fitch served, 180 men, nearly 2/3 of the regiment, including the commanding officer, Colonel Jedediah Huntington, were too sick for duty. "Sickness prevails greatly in camp," recorded a regimental surgeon, Albigence Waldo, adding that in other camps conditions were worse. "The vile water here sickens us all," wrote the New Jersey chaplain Philip Fithian, who was himself ill. "One died this morning in our hospital of a dysentery. 2 died yesterday in the New England hospital of a dysentery, and 30 more are confined with it and other putrid disorders. Many also through the camp are much unwell, but will not go to the hospital. Poor Mr. Donaldson, my old neighbor, is among these. Yesterday he went to the hospital, but crawled back to his tent this morning and resolves there to die rather than return." As they had so often at Boston, Washington and his generals insisted on all possible cleanliness. Nathanael Greene, in particular, gave repeated orders that the camp be kept clean, that the vaults, as latrines were known, were covered with fresh earth daily and new vaults dug weekly. The general also forbids in the most positive terms, Greene had written in his orders of July 28th, the troops easing themselves in the ditches of the fortifications, a practice that is disgraceful to the last degree. If these matters are not attended to, the stench arising from such places will soon breed a pestilence in the camp. It was thought that anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 men were sick. The numbers of Washington's men are daily diminishing, wrote an English visitor who had recently escaped from the provincials at New York. They desert in large bodies, are sickly, filthy, divided, and unruly. Putrid disorders, the smallpox in particular, have carried off great numbers. When I left the city, there were 6,000 in their hospitals, to which use they have converted King's College. General Heath would later estimate that 10,000 of the army were ill. In almost every barn, stable, shed, and even under the fences and bushes were the sick to be seen, whose countenances were but an index of the dejection of spirit and the distress they endured. And those who had not yet been taken down lived with the constant dread that their turn could be next. These things are melancholy, but they are nevertheless true, Washington reported to Hancock. I hope for better. Under every disadvantage, my utmost exertions shall be employed to bring about the great end we have in view. And so far as I can judge from the professions and apparent disposition of my troops, I shall have their support. The superiority of the enemy and the expected attack do not seem to have depressed their spirits. It had been a long time waiting. By mid-August, it had been more than 4 months since the army had set off from Boston for New York, and hurry was the order of the day. The British had not arrived until the end of June, and then, instead of attacking at once as Washington expected, they had kept him watching and waiting week after week as still more of their navy and more troops arrived. Whatever their plans, or however little time remained in the season for action, they seemed inexplicably in no hurry whatever. Washington's quandary over where the British would strike and how to apportion the strength he had was no less extreme now than it had been at the start. Greene and Reed, whose judgment he valued most, were certain the enemy would attack Long Island, both because of the numbers of Loyalists there and the broad, accessible beaches, where troops could readily land under the protection of British ships. But Washington worried that a landing on Long Island might be a diversion in advance of a full assault on New York. And with no way of knowing, he felt compelled now to violate one of the oldest, most fundamental rules of battle: never to divide your strength when faced by a superior force. He split his army in roughly equal parts, on the theory that he could move men one way or the other over the East River, according to how events unfolded. In a long report to Washington dated August 15th, Greene stressed a further cause for concern. The new troops coming over to Long Island, besides being undisciplined, inexperienced, poorly armed, and poorly equipped, were strangers to the ground. They had no familiarity with the lay of the land, a subject Greene considered of greatest importance. They will not be so apt to support each other in time of action as those who have long been acquainted, and who are not only attached to each other, but to the place. He confirmed that the troops were in exceeding good spirits, and that, like Washington, he took heart from this. Only at the conclusion did he acknowledge with regret that he was confined to his bed with a raging fever. Greene, the officer who had been the most concerned of all about the health of the troops, was himself stricken at the crucial hour. At meetings of the British High Command, General Henry Clinton had been making a case for an attack at the northern end of York Island, up the Hudson, but in one conference after another, found he could get nowhere with William Howe, who had other plans. On the morning of Sunday, August 18th, Taking advantage of a strong northeasterly wind, the Phoenix and the Rose passed briskly back down the Hudson to rejoin the fleet. At one point during their sojourn upriver, the Americans had sent a fireship, a ship set ablaze, against the Phoenix, but to no avail. And on the return passage, American guns had blasted